President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet is quickly taking shape as some nominees begin meeting with key senators. If confirmed, Trump's new team will be entrusted to deliver his agenda. Among his priorities, the president-elect has made promises of mass deportations, and he wants to give broad oversight of the healthcare sector to former presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr., selecting him to head the Department of Health and Human Services. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today, we're going to talk about the next administration's stated plans for immigration and healthcare and what they could mean locally, starting with immigration. Joining me now are University of Cincinnati College of Law Director of International Peace and Security Initiatives, Julie Leftwich. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. And from the law office of Nazli Mamyadebyo. I'll get it right the next time.
Okay.
Attorney Nazli Mamyadebda. Thank you for being here, Nazli.
Thank you so much for having us.
And we are hoping in a little bit later to have Haitian Support Center Executive Director Vils Dorsenbiel with us later. We'll keep our fingers crossed that we can connect with him. UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Julie, President-elect Trump, as I mentioned, has promised these mass deportations. He's been somewhat vague about what that means and how it could happen. What do we know?
Well, Lucy, what we know is that he's promised to deport millions of immigrants. He has stated that he will have large facilities for holding them, he'll create large facilities for holding them. We also know that they are looking at revoking the statuses of people who are here, people who might have temporary protective status, a humanitarian parole. I even saw that could include, Afghans who have humanitarian parole, who were, evacuated from Afghanistan. So looking at really, really broad efforts, well beyond anything that's ever happened in this country. I think I read that we've never deported more than 250,000 people in a single year. And he's promising to deport millions of people, which, there are certainly logistical problems with that. There are political problems with that. And I think, I would posit that although they say that this is for the border security and for U.S. security, I would say that this is really the opposite of security. If we really look at what's going to happen locally, nationally, and really globally, if something like this happens.
Well, and Nazli, Julie just mentioned that this is not only people who are in this country without authorization, that he's talking about people who have legal status to be here. But when we look at people who are in the U.S. without the proper documentation or authorization, how many people is that roughly? I mean, what's that population look like? Do we know?
So it's very hard to say because a lot of immigrants who are undocumented are very hard to account for. But we're talking about, 13 million, right? About 13 million people. And the thing is, and Julia actually alluded to that, is that it's not just 13 million people that are undocumented, or have some kind of temporary protection, but it's also their U.S. citizen relatives and children. Communities across the United States and locally are in fear, in a great fear, because one of the nominees for the incoming administration, Holman, stated that, parts of those deportations is not just undocumented or immigrants with the temporary protections, but also their U.S. citizen children, or other relatives. One of the ways they are trying to remedy the separation of children and parents that happened during the past administration is now basically saying, we're going to deport the whole family.
In an interview this weekend with Meet the Press, host Kristen Welker cited a figure of around 3% of people who are here without proper authorization who have committed crimes, which seems to be in contrast to the language that President-elect Trump has been using to describe people who were here without authorization. What do we know about crime statistics when it comes to people who are here without authorization? Julie, is that 3% about on target?
Yeah, I think so. It's a very, very small percentage of people here. In fact, ICE recently, Immigration and Customs Enforcement recently released a letter that said, basically stated that it's a very small percentage of people that they have in deportation proceedings that have committed crimes or have convictions. And if we think about that, you know, that 13 million people that Nazli mentioned, it is about 3 or 4% of that. So that's, you know, when I talk about security, we have to look at, is this really helping security? Are these making, is this making our local securities, our local communities more secure? And it's not. In fact, you know, the crime rates among citizens are much, much higher. You know, we've had programs under past administrations, under the Bush administration, then Obama, called the Safe Communities programs, where they started fingerprinting everybody who was detained, you know, to look in a database to see if people were deportable. And it was shown that that did not make communities safer at all. So we're really not addressing you know, the crime that's happening in communities, which is mostly by U.S. citizens. And I think what worries me as well is that President-elect Trump has stated that he will, if necessary, divert resources. He will use the military to start rounding people up, which I think is worrisome for several reasons. One, because, you know, this is not an actual emergency. If we're taking U.S. Troops and forces and, you know, putting their attention on this, it means they're not paying attention to things that are actually a security threat. And I think, you know, also militarizing these things, you know, I work internationally on issues of human rights and women, peace, and security. What we see in other countries is when there's increased militarization, there's less security in the community because there's more fear, there's more violence, there's more oppression. So again, we have to really look at what the true security concerns are, and it's not the number of immigrants who are actually criminals.
We're also joined now by Viles d'Orsainville. Thank you so much for being here. Viles, you're the Haitian Support Center Executive Director in Springfield, Ohio. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me.
We appreciate your being here. Another major issue that came up in that Meet the Press interview we were just talking about was family separation. As you mentioned, Nazli, here is what the president-elect had to say.
We don't have to separate families. Yeah. We'll send the whole family very humanely back to the country where they came. That way the family's not separated.
So no more family separations. You're not reviving
the
zero tolerance
policy. Well, it depends on the family. The family may decide to say, I'd rather have dad go, and we'll stay here. And in which case, they have that option.
Nazli, what would that mean for children who were born in the U.S. and have at least one parent who is undocumented? I mean, and do we have any idea how many children we're talking about who fit that description?
I don't know how many children we feed, we're talking about, but I will tell you this, majority of population, especially among the immigrant population, has at least two children. And not all the time we have children who were born here, you know, sometimes within the family, one might have been born here and one might have been born back in the home country. But just the thought of sending U.S. citizen children and deporting them with their parents is just unbelievable and inhumane from the point of view of separating, you know, families or doing that to U.S. citizen children. Kind of, for me, it brings up the history of our country, you know, when we treated the citizens differently based on their nation, nationality and their origins, you know, when we put the Japanese in internment camps, right, the Chinese Expulsion Act, all these things when we treated U.S. citizens still differently because of their race, ethnicity, or their national origins. And I think this is going to be a huge issue. This also going to touch on communities locally, right? Our domestic courts will have to be involved, right? The children's services, who are already overworked and overwhelmed, this is going to create chaos in states. the deportation itself, the process, is very complex, and also how much funding we will be doing for sending the, you know, children and families and others out of the United States and deporting them. I am not sure we are going to be able to do it humanely either. Mm-hmm. And this is very concerning.
VLA Springfield, Ohio has been at the center of a lot of rhetoric about immigrants from President-elect Trump and Vice President-elect Vance. You're living in Springfield under temporary protected status, as I understand it. Explain what that status means to you.
Thank you once again for having me. The temporary protected status is a status that any current government can issue to a particular country when that country is experiencing some kind of war or political upheaval, and the citizens who are here, the citizens of that country who are here in the USA, cannot go back to their country. So you have to be in the USA to be eligible for temporary protected status. If you're outside of the USA, you're not eligible for that status. But if you're in the USA and your country is in trouble, now you are eligible for it. So in Springfield, because of the political upheaval in Haiti and the assassination of the former president Jovenel Moïse, there's so much turmoil, and if you read the report of the United Nations last week, you would have seen that 184 people were slaughtered by gangsters in Haiti. So people who are here under the temporary protected status, they were pushed away in Haiti because of that insecurity and all those kidnapping cases. So this is the type of status it is. So they issued you the status for 18 months. For people in Springfield here, I think that it will be expired in February 3rd, 2026. So, but the biggest worriness that they have here is that they're afraid that the president-elect do not revoke the status, because automatically he revokes the status, they will be obligated just to leave the country, or they will be here illegally.
We're talking about what the incoming Trump administration's immigration priorities could mean locally. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Viles, there are thousands of Haitians who have moved to Springfield in recent years. Are they pretty much all under this temporary protected status?
I think this is a very good question that should be clear for your audience. We do not have here an official statistics of how many Haitians are here in Springfield, but the city officials speak between 15,000 to 20,000. Some Haitians here, they have resided in Green Card because they were living before in Florida or Boston or Massachusetts, and they came here. They relocated here in Springfield because of affordable housing and job search. The second category of Haitians here, their status is asylum. They are asylum seekers. And the third and category of Haitians living in Springfield are the new arrival from last year under the Polo program. And the fourth category is the temporary protected status citizens who are here in Springfield. So you would find, I cannot normally have a statistic to say that this amount of people are under the temporary status or under asylum or have green cards or residence or anything. But what I know is that not all Haitians here in Springfield are under the temporary protected status.
Okay. Well, we're going to continue our conversation after a short break, and later in the program, we'll discuss the new administration's health care priorities and what those could mean locally. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our discussion about what the incoming Trump administration's immigration priorities could mean locally. My guests are University of Cincinnati College of Law Director of International Peace and Security Initiatives, Julie Leftwich, Law Office of Nazli Mamyadeva. Nazli Mamyadeva. Attorney Nazli Mamyadeva. And Haitian Support Center Executive Director Viles Dorsenville. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk at wvxu.org. We've got more to discuss about Springfield, but I want to circle back to another topic that's come up a lot. And Julie, something the president-elect has made very clear is that he wants to end birthright citizenship. Talk to us about what the 14th Amendment says about this and whether he can get around that through some kind of executive action.
Sure. Well, I think this is a very other disturbing part of what he's talking about. So the 14th Amendment from 1868, which is the Equal Protection Amendment, says that any person that is born on U.S. soil is a citizen. It does say somebody who is subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which is where, you know, people are trying to say that immigrants are not subject, quote unquote, to the jurisdiction of the United States. But it's been settled precedent for over 150 years that by the Supreme Court that this does apply to immigrants regardless of their parents' status. The only way to change the Constitution is by a constitutional amendment, which is a lengthy and complicated process. It requires supermajorities of the House and Senate, and also it has to be approved by 3/4 of state legislatures. So, you know, if you just look at the numbers of Republicans and Democrats just alone, there aren't the numbers that the president would need. He has talked about doing this by executive order, which he cannot do, first of all. And, you know, I, as a human rights, international human rights lawyer, I'm always looking at issues of human rights and rule of law. And, you know, again, what we see in other countries when we have authoritarian regimes is this notion that the president or the leader can just change the Constitution. He's also stated that, you know, it could be regulated by an act of Congress. Now, Congress does have the power to regulate immigration. But again, this birthright citizenship is in the Constitution. So certainly anything that might happen in Congress or be done by executive order would be challenged in the courts and would likely go up to the Supreme Court. You know, unfortunately, the way the court is these days, we can't be quite as sure that it would follow past precedent because it has been in changing precedent. But, you know, this notion that he could just change this and revoke this birthright citizenship is just incorrect.
Well, and there would be implications for everyone if birthright citizenship were just broadly revoked, wouldn't there be, Julie? I mean, talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So if we think about it, what do we use to show our citizenship or enroll in schools or get driver's licenses? We use our birth certificate, right? Because if that says that we were born here, that means we're a citizen. So if birthright citizenship goes away, that means that you can't necessarily use your birth certificate. So that affects not just immigrant population, but all of us. So what will we have to show, those of us who were born here, what will we have to show to prove that our children are citizens and they derived citizenship from us? So, you know, again, that affects everybody. And I think it's, you know, also big picture as we're talking about this, it's really important for everybody to understand how destabilizing deporting millions of people would be to our communities and to all of us. You know, we're talking about taking away millions of people who are part of our economy. People who have status are paying taxes. A lot of people, even who don't have status, people don't understand that they are paying taxes. So we, lose taxes, we lose consumers, we lose workers in a lot of industries. I'm sure if you talk to people in the construction and service and agriculture industries, they would tell you that if all of a sudden all these people were gone, they would have problems finding employees. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about inflation. Prices would go up. So there's a lot of different ways that this will affect everybody and not just the immigrant population. I think it's really important to understand that. And I, like I said, this is really the opposite of security. This is causing more insecurity and instability in our communities and for all of us.
Vilas, I want to come back to you. We were talking before the break about the different kind of statuses that people originally from Haiti have in Springfield, Ohio. It sounds like, although there are differences, that most, if not all, of the Haitian population living in Springfield are in this country legally. They're either pursuing asylum or they've got green cards or they've got this temporary protected status. But this rhetoric from the Trump-Vance campaign led to bomb threats and other threats in your community. Can you talk to us a little bit about the impact that that's had on you and other Haitians in Springfield?
Yeah, I think that it has been so disturbing for the community because Springfield has been in the spotlight. And that created some kind of anxiety and fear, and people has been so panicked that they didn't even want to come out to go to the groceries or anything as such when that happened. But now things get a little bit calmer. But the rhetoric still goes its way in terms of people living with anxiety. Now it's not about the eating pets rhetoric, but it's about now deporting them or terminating their status just to send them back to the same situation that pushed them to leave the country. And the question of bomb threats, it was so disturbing because when it comes to bomb threats, even though people say that it's not a legitimate, but at the end of the day, it's bomb threats. And this is not something that would impact only Haitian, but the school was shut down and the annual festival of the community was canceled because of the situation. And there wasn't any big gathering. So much a disturbance in the community because of that rhetoric. So I came to the realization how the words of a leader can impact the community, whether negatively or positive, in a positive way. So Springfield has been like so disturbed, but now we are trying to face the post-trauma by trying in our center to educate the folks on mental health issue and also implementing programs about know their rights and help them to understand their status so that they can take the right decision if they want to stay in Springfield or if they want to leave. So our responsibility is to educate them on some issues just to help them not only deal with the anxiety, that has been going through, and also for them, if they want to take a decision, for them to have like a clear idea what their rights are in the United States as immigrants, and also what does the status mean to them.
Natalie, what are you advising people who are in this country, either with authorization like Vilas or maybe without authorization? We've talked about how there's a lot of fear. What advice are you giving people these days?
It depends. So a lot of times when people do have path to maybe, you know, legalizing through their U.S. citizen relatives or some other options of filing an asylum, or sometimes there is an employment-based immigration, we would advise them to check their options, to go consult with local attorneys. You know, there's a couple of nonprofits here in Cincinnati that they can also see. Also, locally, there is an Immigrant Dignity Coalition that exists, and we're actually, my law office is part of it, and it consists of numerous organizations. We're trying to start preparing for, you know, kind of having strategies on, like, what do you do if your parents arrested by ICE or the family is, and, you know, what the plans should be in place, documentation and other things. I do strongly suggest to people, like, get all your documents together, have a plan, you know, prepare your packets, apply for the passports for your children who are U.S. citizen children just in case, have the powers of attorneys, you know, have things in place that if things happen, they do happen very quick. The deportation is very sometimes quick process, and that you are prepared at least on some level.
Well, I've been talking with University of Cincinnati College of Law Director of International Peace and Security Initiatives, Julie Leftwich. Also, Nazli Mamyadovya, who is an attorney with the Law Office of Nazli Mamyadovya, and Haitian Support Center Executive Director, Veels Dorsenville. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate your being with us to discuss this very important issue.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Lucy.
Up next, we'll talk about the new administration's healthcare priorities and what those could mean locally. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We just heard what the next Trump administration's immigration priorities could mean locally. Now we turn to President-elect Donald Trump's nominees to lead the nation's healthcare system. Joining me are University of Cincinnati Vice Chair for Clinical Research for Internal Medicine, Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum. Welcome back, Dr. Fichtenbaum.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Great to have you as always, and national healthcare reporter for the Washington Post, Dan Diamond. Thanks for being here, Dan.
Thanks for having me from Washington, D.C.
UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Dan, let's discuss President-elect Trump's choice of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's something of a self-proclaimed environmentalist and health guru. Can you tell us a little about his personal philosophy?
Well, he is, Lucy, someone who spent a lot of time in environmental activism. That is true. He achieved a number of environmental wins. He had a number of Democratic politicians support him. There was even talk at one point that he might serve in the Obama administration in a senior role. So he is someone who, to many Democrats, was a hero for a long time. In recent years, though, things have flipped. And a lot of that is because he has been openly skeptical, critical of vaccines. It might be even underselling to say that. He founded an anti-vaccine group. So his theory of the case is that there are lots of pollutants in the world, many brought by industry, that have harmed Americans. And that is one reason why American health outcomes lag behind other countries. And as health secretary, if he's confirmed, he has an agenda that he plans to pursue in hopes of turning some of that around. Hmm.
You mentioned that RFK Jr. has been described as an anti-vaxxer, something he says he's not.
I'm not going to take away anybody's vaccines. I've never been anti-vaccine. I'm going to make sure scientific safety studies and efficacies are out there and people can make individual assessments about whether that product is going to be good for them.
Dan, what have his public positions been on vaccines?
Well, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has questioned all manner of vaccines. He's questioned some of the vaccines that children get, whether kids are getting too many, whether they're getting them too quickly, and has suggested that if he is in a position of power, maybe that schedule would change. He wants to do more data reviews, he said, which in some ways sounds good. More data is always helpful. But as public health experts, and I'm sure Dr. Fichtenbaum can speak to this too, can attest to, vaccines are incredibly studied. We've seen over decades, the benefits of some vaccines and eliminating the occurrence of disease like polio here in the States. So his skepticism of vaccines has veered, Lucy, beyond just raising questions, but actually influencing behavior. He has gone around the world and met with lawmakers in places like Samoa, urging them against using, say, the MMR vaccine. And Samoa is a place where there was a vaccine preventable, an outbreak of vaccine preventable disease, measles, that led to dozens of children dying. So these are not just empty statements and idle questions. These are things that once you start talking about them, to be very, very careful that you're not contributing to people deciding not to get vaccinated because they are suddenly skeptical.
Dr. Fichtenbaum, let's talk about vaccine studies. What can you walk us through what we know about existing vaccine studies and anything that you know about what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is suggesting about more study of vaccines that we use in this country?
Yeah, so public health is really, really important. And the first initial vaccination studies by Dr. Jenner many, many years ago noticed that the individuals, the milkmaids who were using, who were milking cows were getting cowpox. And these were individuals who did not get smallpox. And ever since that discovery, we've been on a journey to find vaccines to prevent diseases. Smallpox ravaged the earth for centuries, and we vaccinated individuals for this, and smallpox does not exist anymore, which means that people no longer have that disease. And in over the past probably seven decades, we have gone through a very careful process that has gotten more and more careful over the years of testing vaccinations. We want to know, do they do what we think they're going to do, and are they safe? And there's been a number of vaccines that have been shown not to be safe, and they haven't been approved. And so there is a really rigorous process now in the United States, monitored by the FDA, that if you want to bring to market a new vaccine, you have to go through a standard process to determine, is it safe and does it have effectiveness to be able to help human beings? So I think, and there are also some additional measures in the U.S. There's a vaccine adverse effect reporting service called VAERS that's run and administered by the CDC, where anybody, including a patient, can report a adverse vaccine effect. So there is a place where people can alert authorities that I'm having a problem with the vaccine. Now, it is really, really hard to sometimes figure out whether this vaccine or another illness or something is causing a problem. But really, we have a very good system for testing vaccines and bringing them to market.
We're talking about the incoming Trump administration's healthcare priorities and what they could mean locally. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So Dan, with that background on how vaccines are improved, with what you've told us about RFK Jr. and what he's said about vaccines, if he does become the head of Health and Human Services, what impact could he have on the vaccines that are recommended for children and adults?
Pretty significant one. He could change the recommendations that are coming out from the federal agencies. So even though states and local schools for a long time have followed those federal recommendations, they might be in a bind. Suddenly, the RFK Jr.-led agency is saying things that historically it didn't. So what will states and local schools and others do? So I think that's one change. Another thing that RFK Jr. could do is he could put different experts on these committees who make recommendations. So historically, these have been public health experts who are well-regarded. RFK Jr. could find vaccine skeptics to sit on the CDC and FDA committees and make different recommendations or even recommendations that go against what the public health community thinks. And then he could just do administrative things. Vaccines are produced at factories and plants that need to undergo federal inspection. RFK Jr. could just delay those inspections, maybe indefinitely. So vaccines wouldn't necessarily be taken from the market, but more vaccines might be very delayed in coming to market. there are other aspects too. This would be a very powerful position that RFK Jr. would have if confirmed by the Senate, with vast powers over the U.S. health system.
And Dan, are there any ways in which it could become more difficult to access vaccines with RFK Jr. at the head of this huge agency?
Well, certainly if there are updated vaccines that need to be approved, that strikes me as a challenge. So every year we get new flu vaccine or we get updates to the COVID vaccine. RFK Jr. may slow walk those vaccines and also might take away some liability protections for pharmaceutical companies. That's something he's talked about wanting to do, that pharmaceutical companies have been too protected from patients who might have had adverse reactions. That could make pharmaceutical companies less eager to work on vaccines and pull back some of their production.
Well, my understanding is, too, that many drug manufacturers don't make a ton of money on a lot of these recommended vaccines. Is it possible that if the federal government stops recommending children get these vaccines and the federal government stops paying for low-income kids to get them, and I know that's a lot of ifs, I mean, could there be an impact on the companies that make them to the point where maybe some of the companies will decide, hey, this isn't good business anymore?
It's an interesting question, certainly possible in a world where anything can happen. I will say that we saw during COVID, as some of the COVID need, or at least perceived need, dried up, some companies pulled back on what they were making and doing, not just vaccines, but broader COVID testing and other supplies. Pharmaceutical companies are for profit. They're going to look for where the profits are, and they don't want to be where the risks are. If there is less money being available for vaccine production, if there are more risks involved in producing them, absolutely they could pull back on making some of these. I do think the public health need, though, and the outcry would be pretty significant and would make it hard, even if the federal government is throwing up these barriers, it would be hard to see pharmaceutical companies completely retreating from that, because at the end of the day, there are lots of people well beyond RFK Jr. who help oversee the industry. There are state officials in states where these plants are located. There are senators in Congress who believe strongly in vaccines, even in the Republican Party. So I don't see a full retreat from the market.
RFK Jr. has also talked about his Make America Healthy Again plan. He says that's focused on preventing chronic disease. Dan, what can you tell us about that approach?
There is truth, Lucy, that here in America, we die earlier than our peers abroad. We get sicker. Some of that is because of a health system that is focused more on intervention than prevention through financial incentives on, say, how Medicare might pay providers who are caring for patients. Some of the things that RFK Jr. has talked about doing are changing the subsidies for crops and moving the incentives away from corn and soybeans and toward healthier production by farms. There are things he'd like to do that are more in the wheelhouse of the health department, like changing the funding of various researchers who might have, he says, conflicts of interest with the pharma industry because they're too focused on prescriptions and not on other forms of care. Some of what he wants to do, in fact, much of what he wants to do, Lucy, are things that Democrats have said they want to do. I was standing in Congress a few weeks ago, a few feet from Senator Cory Booker, a Democrat from New Jersey, who spoke for minutes about all the things he essentially agreed with RFK Jr. on. There are other ideas that he has that are more out there that don't have the same support. He's floated ideas around taking fluoride out of community water systems. That's gotten some resistance. He has some ideas, too, that go beyond what he would have power to affect as HHS secretary, like the agricultural ideas.
We're definitely going to talk about fluoride in this conversation, but part of his approach to health seems to also be a reaction against the establishment.
We don't have good science because the agencies deliberately don't do that science because they don't want people to know what they're eating. What I'm going to do is make sure that Americans have good information, good, the best gold standard science about their food and medicines, and then leave the choice to them.
Dr. Fichtenbaum, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what do you think? Do we have good science? Do we not have good science in this country?
Well, I think there are real conflicts with pharmaceutical products, and I can probably speak to that better than I can the food supply. But in the pharma industry area, you know, much of the funding surrounds products that can be brought to market. And there are two things that have to happen. One is we have to prove safety, and the other is we have to prove that there's some benefit. And so when it comes to safety, the pharma industry is very careful about how it organizes its studies so that products can get to market. Otherwise, they make a very huge investment and get no return. And so there is an inherent problem in our system where we don't always get all the information that we really need about medications or even vaccinations, because there is a conflict of interest that they don't necessarily want to study things in as great detail, especially if there may be side effects from it. And there are many problems that don't get studied as well as they could be, because it's possible that some of those problems are related to either industry products or things like that. And so certainly the pharma industry does not want to finance that. And so as scientists, when we want to study human health and disease, we want to study all aspects of this, but there's only a limited number of dollars. And so there are some of these inherent conflicts, which I do agree represent a problem for human health. But I think the more important thing is that we really need a public health system in the United States. We don't have that. It is not something that we've invested in. We have really a health illness system where we're really trying to delay or prevent or treat illnesses rather than promote health in our country. And in part, I think that's because there isn't the same level of return on investment for promoting health. So making sure that there are really good, affordable grocery stores in every neighborhood, making sure that people can get vaccinations at appropriate time for free, making sure that people can get good health advice. We don't even put good health promotion advice on television or in social media very much. And that's a tremendous loss, because we could reach so many people. So really there are some issues, I think, where I would tend to agree that we need to make some changes if we want to improve human health in the U.S. But I don't think we should abandon our vaccinations, because I'll just tell you one anecdotal story. You know, when I was a young practitioner, I trained in both pediatrics and adult medicine, and I used to see little babies with something called Haemophilus influenza meningitis. Sometimes they lost their lives. Sometimes they actually had devastation that they couldn't hear, they couldn't learn, they couldn't keep up with their peers. And they were very much like they had had a terrible stroke as a little child. We don't see this illness anymore because a vaccine was developed and children get vaccinated at a very early age. And so my contemporaries who are now physicians don't see this anymore. I had one of my teachers in high school who had polio and walked around using assistance from crutches. We don't see that anymore because we have polio vaccines. So I think what people forget is the tremendous impact that vaccination has had on saving lives and preventing disease. And so we really need to move in a way that we are making sure that the public understands the benefits as well as the risks, and that we're not fear-mongering about health because we're worried about some of the conflict of interest that we have, or whether this industry or that industry has our best interests in mind. We have to remember the really important things about protecting the health of our country.
I want to come back to fluoride. There's been much focus on RFK Jr.'s thoughts about fluoride in the water system.
I think Florida is on the way out because of that court decision. I think the faster that it goes out, the better. I'm not going to compel anybody to take it out, but I'm going to advise the water districts about their legal liability, their legal obligation to their service zones and to their constituents. And I'm going to give them good information about the science. And I think that fluoride will disappear.
Dan, talk to us briefly about the science with fluoride and whether you think municipalities will stop adding it to the water. Are you with us, Dan? Ooh, we might have lost Dan. Well, Dr. Fichtenbaum, tell us briefly about the science on fluoride. Has fluoride become controversial in the water?
Well, I don't think so necessarily. I think that we've seen tremendous benefits where the number of children with cavities and dental disease has really decreased quite a bit. I mean, everybody knows the old story of George Washington and his wooden teeth. I don't think we want to go back to a time where children are having tremendous cavities and dental disease. And I think that the science behind fluoride is very thin, that it is something dangerous. So, for example, many of the studies that have been done in other countries using populations where there's a number of different health issues and problems in it. And I think it would be wrong to assume and determine that fluoride is the cause of all of these problems. So I think it would be really, really important to have a discussion about the science of fluoride and the benefits of it. Now, of course, anything that is in too high a level is not a good thing for people. But right now, the fluoridation of the water supply that we had is not something that I think necessarily there is a proven detriment to human health. So I would be a little bit wary about removing fluoride from all of the water, because I think what we'll have in a decade is a lot of dentists who will be doing a lot of cavities for a lot of children.
I want to mention before I forget that all the audio we've used in this conversation from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is courtesy of NBC News. Dr. Fichtenbaum, we are running out of time, but, you know, we've talked to you a lot about on this program about COVID-19, other infectious diseases. Just briefly, what are you worried about? What kind of infectious disease is out there that has the potential to be the next pandemic? And you've only got about 30 seconds.
Well, I think we always have to keep our guard up. I think that influenza is something that always has the ability to change. And we've heard a little bit about a recent bird flu where there can be a single mutation change, and that may cause a problem. I think climate change has changed the number of pathogens that people are coming in contact with. So lots of germs. So I think the combination of our climate warming, that there's going to be many different germs that people will come in contact with.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Vice Chair for Clinical Research for Internal Medicine, Dr. Carl Fichtenbaum, and National Health Reporter for The Washington Post, Dan Diamond. Thank you both so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.